And welcome to the Anarchist Book Club, with Annie Evans and me, Jim Yeoman. After a few months off, we're really excited to return with a brilliant guest, Zoe Baker, alias Anarchopac, the author of Means and Ends, The Revolutionary Practice of Anarchism in Europe and the United States, which was published with AK Press in 2023. There's a link to this book in the notes to the show. Zoe's book provides an engaging and accessible overview of the revolutionary strategy of anarchism from 1868 to 1939. Zoe is also host of one of the most popular and respected YouTube channels on the left, which you can also find in the notes to this episode. I hope you enjoy the discussion. Zoe, thanks for being here on our sort of return to podcasting. It's an absolute pleasure to welcome you onto the podcast. You know, we've got loads to talk about, loads of big ideas, loads of big themes about anarchism, but we thought a good place to start would be thinking about the process of writing, you know, your book, which has come out with AK Press, and the PhD, which it kind of came from, whilst simultaneously having one of the most popular and respected YouTube channels on the left. That's an amazing kind of context in which to produce this work, and we'd just like to hear a bit more about it.
So the way I wrote it is that I kind of viewed it like, if you think about video games, they often have like certain mechanics that are just repeated over and over again. And that's essentially what I did. So if you look at the book, what you'll notice is that it's essentially a series of quotes with framing and context between them, and then an illustrative example. And I was, and the book is essentially me doing that over and over and over again, where the quotes are like laid out in a historical order, so you can then see how the ideas change over time. Or they're framed in terms of argument structure. So over and over again, I'll be like, you know, their first argument was this, their second argument was that, their third argument was that, and so forth and so forth. And I'm essentially just doing that over and over and over again. So it's this kind of what thinking when I was writing, I was always thinking about, you just do it kind of block by block. And then before you know it, you have like a book, and then it's just about arranging everything. So it is like a, someone can follow the chain of ideas. So then the main goal early on was gathering as much information as possible in the form of quotes and timelines of quotes, so I could track how ideas and crucially terminology changed over time. I became kind of like obsessed with terminology changes, like, you know, when does the word anarchism appear? Because in the early sources, like, they don't use the term, and all of a sudden in 1880, Kropotkin's being like, anarchism. I'm like, how did that happen? And so what I would do is I would use kind of like note-taking software like Evernote or OneNote, and I would have a table, and in the table I have the author, the date, the topic, and also the kind of where it was published. And then I copy the quote in with a page reference, and I would do that for every single author I was reading as I was reading them. And the idea then was that if I want to know what anarchists thought about something, I just look it up in the quote library. And I have like 50 quotes on, say, their view. And what the reason for this was that I didn't want to write a history that was really just like what Bakunin thought or just what Kropotkin thought. I wanted to see what they had in common and where they differed, or how they expressed the same ideas in different ways. And to do that, I had to keep track of this, resulting in this like monumental quote library. And the idea then was, when I'm making YouTube videos, while an overworked, extremely tired PhD student, well, I just have to copy and paste quotes from the quote library into a Word document, link it together, and then that's a video, say, on like, what did Malatesta think about violence, or what did Reclus think about animal liberation? The problem I had was that as the PhD goes on, and I become more and more overworked, I become less hardcore at making sure everything goes into the quote library. I become increasingly like, I, you know, I can't be asked to type in like where it was published, you know, so like the, and so it's kind of like an unfinished project, because the actual end goal was meant to be, I create this like website called the Anarchist Quote Library. And the idea was that other historians who didn't want to have to say, read through the indexes or word search, like all of Bakunin or all of Malatesta in English, they could just type in Malatesta freedom and they have every single quote, because I am a like perfectionist and gone through it all for them, and it's there. And that, and then the idea was that that would make it easier for people to, one, like research and see like definitions and ideas, categorized by topic, but also for like lay people who you know, just on the internet, who want to learn about anarchism. It was also often for like for the purpose of Twitter, because like, I would like post a quote on Twitter every day, and that was always just a quote from the quote library. And this is also why like I keep quoting from the same authors. It's because they're the ones that I have the most quotes of in the quote library, because they're the authors I read first in the PhD before the end of the PhD, when I was way less good at like putting everyone in. And so yeah, that was kind of like the methodology. And then I throw in historical examples to illustrate, and deliberately trying to make sure that they like, I had this problem. I know it was a few years into the PhD, I realized that all my examples were overwhelmingly from Spain and Italy, because they happened to be the books that I first read about, like when I was writing. And so then I spent ages reading about like American stuff, looking for examples so I could add in the American context. So it didn't look like I'd accidentally written a book where I'm quoting American authors like Emma Goldman and Alexander Berkman, but never American examples. And that was just due to like the order in which I read things.
That's really interesting. So do you think you might resuscitate the idea of the Anarchist Quote Library?
Yeah, it's on my like to-do list. I'm like, I'm going to finish it. It's going to be my big project. It's going to be a website.
I find that process fascinating, because it, in terms of your approach to, you know, this kind of volume of material, it was quite similar to what I did with Anarchist Newspapers. Was, you know, I had to come up with some sort of way of divvying it up, coming up with the system. And then also, like you've mentioned there, trying to find a way so that if someone else wanted to do it, they wouldn't have to do what I'd done. And I wonder if that's a part of writing a PhD, is, you know, for kind of conscientious people, is to be like, well, no one else should have to do this legwork to make it happen. But the difference, I guess, is that what you're producing is something that people would want to go and look at, whereas what I was looking at was fairly obscure, you know, newspapers from Spain. So I think it would be a really, you know, that would be a tremendous thing to come out of it too. When you started talking then about the kind of your approach to it, though, which was quite different, thinking about it in these kind of blocks or chunks, you know, the way that you've approached the kind of quote and the thing that comes with it, do you think that was done in mind of also reproducing it in a different way through YouTube, in a different way through Twitter, or they came out of the process of doing the PhD research first?
I often feel like I don't really have original ideas. I'm just really good at summarizing other people's ideas. And that's like my skill set. And so on YouTube, I quickly pivoted to like, I'm just going to explain like, what did Bakunin think? That's something I can do in a way that I don't feel confident to be like, you know, this is what I think about how we should save the world and destroy capitalism. I can be like, well, this is what the dead anarchists thought and why. And so that kind of became just like my writing style. Was entirely, and then I wanted to show that like, well, my interpretation is correct. And so I just go, okay, I'm going to quote the entire paragraph, like massive block quotes. And that kind of just became my default writing style, because how I kind of learned to write was arguing on like Reddit about the history of socialism. And to prove you're right, I'm going to quote the massive thing to be like, look, they said this, you haven't read stuff. Give me up votes, hell yeah. And then same on like, you know, YouTube, where I like would make, you know, videos about what Marx and Engels thought. And so I thought, you know, I got to quote them loads to show that, you know, this isn't me, the anarchist, making stuff up. This is what they themselves say. So it was also to kind of like show my working to strangers on the internet. Like I didn't want people to ever take my word for it just because like I'm doing a PhD or now like I am a doctor. I wanted them to see my working, because I can get things wrong, and also other people can notice things that I don't. So I might have a really particular interpretation, but then other people can look at the same things I'm quoting and be like, oh, you know, there's actually some other ways of reading this. So it was also like for that reason, to make it so that people, when they see how I present the history, are also seeing like where I'm getting this from, which means that they can also fact check me, but also then be more persuaded by me, because they can go, well, yeah, there is a like one-to-one correspondence between what Zoe says they say and what they actually say, because she's just quoted them to a ridiculous extent. And the other motivation behind my kind of like obsession with quoting the primary sources is, you know, a lot of the kind of like early anarchist history books, I'm thinking especially of like Paul Average, who's like really good, but really not good, I think, at explaining ideas accurately. He'll kind of make these like really broad sweeping generalizations about like Bakunin and Kropotkin and what they think with like no quotes to back it up. And then I would like look up his sources and be like, I don't understand how you got this, Average. And so I'd seen, you know, other historians do this as well. So I was like, okay, I don't want to make those kind of mistakes. So I'm going to be as much as possible showing what they say in their own words to prevent misinterpretation. And the other thing was so that a tired, overworked person isn't going to sit down and read like all of Bakunin, but I can quote like a lot of Bakunin, and through reading my book, they're going to be absorbing Bakunin's ideas without ever having to sit down and slog through Statism and Anarchy themselves.
But it's kind of funny, isn't it, that like a lot of this work, which provides like shortcuts for people into anarchism, like has ended up producing this book, which is pretty bulky. Do you see the readership for the book as being the same as the people like who watch the YouTube videos or go on Reddit and things like this? I mean, do you see what I mean? Because like, to me, it seems like, I mean, and this is because I'm an old fogey, right? But the world of books and then the world of like social media and like the second one sort of actively disrupts the first one and makes it hard for people to like read books and things like that because of like the sort of permanent distractions of social media or, you know, the online world. So do you feel like people, like you're helping people make that transition by writing a book that people, you know, in terms of its style and things, as people have got used to through watching your videos and stuff?
I am aware of like, you know, not everyone who is going to read a tweet or watch a video is going to buy the book. But the hope is that well over a few thousand people do, that's still more than would otherwise come into contact with like a bulky book. And, you know, I wanted it to be bulkier, but like AK Press were like, the bigger it is, the less people will buy it because they'll be intimidated by how big it is. And it'll be more expensive, so less people will buy it. And I was like, okay. And so it got like shrunk down. Like, you know, there was so much stuff that was cut that my like perfectionist brain is like, but I can't not talk about the entire history in encyclopedic detail. If I had my way, I would have gone through every single assassination that an anarchist carried out or tried to carry out and every bombing, you know, in order across the entire world. But that doesn't make for fun reading. I mean, for me, it does, but for a lot of people, it's like, you know, repetitive. And then it makes the book unnecessarily long. And, you know, so there were loads of like, there's loads of things where it's like, yeah, that's not in the book, not because I don't know about it, but because I was desperately trying to keep the word count down. Because it had a tendency to keep growing and growing and growing as I you know, learned more things and wanted to add more things. You know, I deliberately write in a really clear, like the writing style of the PhD and the book and my YouTube videos is exactly the same, which is namely how I think and speak. So I think only in words. I can't think visually at all on any level. It's just like imagine my voice in your head constantly talking, never shutting up. And that's like the only way I think. So when I write, it's kind of just like thinking on paper for me in a very literal sense. And so I just try to like write extremely clearly, in part so it means that my own thoughts are clear for me. And then that all, the idea is that the clarity is, it serves two purposes, right? The clarity, both its accessibility, but also it's to do with like rigor. Like I'm very precise about my arguments, about this premise entailing this conclusion. You know, I use philosophy jargon as little as possible, but it is there. Like, you know, I talk about necessary and insufficient conditions and things like that. So there's a kind of like, the precision is both for rigor purposes, because my background's in philosophy, and accessibility purposes. And I try to like write a book that you can kind of dive into, rather than having to like slog through it. So like each chapter you can read as a self-contained video essay, which form a whole, but you should be able to understand a huge amount of those chapters just by themselves. And that's because I kind of approach them like I was writing like a YouTube video.
Yeah, it's really effective. It's really interesting to like hear like this, like the kind of relationship between your video making and social media interaction and the writing of a book. It really feels like I'm at the cutting edge of it. Hearing about this makes you feel like, yeah, this is how books should be written like now to engage people.
Yeah, I'd agree. I think it's fascinating. The idea that, you know, you're writing your PhD with an audience in mind, that's on various forms of social media rather than like what I did. The audience in mind I had was the three academics that were going to read it at the end of the day and say whether it was all right or not. I think it's a really, really interesting way, you know, fascinating way of looking at it, you know, and it does disrupt, like Danny said, part of me, I think, because I, you know, I've come from not that old, I guess, but like an old, you know, a style of historical writing that I think probably does chime a bit more with what Averich is doing, or, you know, you can think of countless others where, as well as that rigor, which you've really outlined really well, there's a literature side of it to history that kind of the book should be, have a beginning, a middle and an end and in all these ways. But you're saying you want these to be digestible takeaway sections. And in reality, that is how people are reading academic books. And so I think there's such potential and such value in thinking about that.
I think it's really interesting you're talking about like a style of historical writing that's like literature, because, you know, my academic background wasn't history, right? It was philosophy. So in analytic philosophy, there's a lot of things that make it horrible to read, like unnecessary use of formal logic, you know, levels of pedantry that are too pedantic, that make it kind of unreadable. And so when I learned how to write, it was about how to have like the rigor of analytic philosophy without it being like reading a kind of instruction manual for assembling a like bookcase, you know, like it has to be engaging and interesting to like read. But I always felt like I didn't write like a historian. Like I didn't have to go through the process of studying history at university and kind of adopting that style. And I feel like there's a lot of really good history, you know, historians that I've read where I feel like I'm reading a storybook, in the sense that there are like characters and events and plot points, but it's real. And that's like, I can find that really engaging to read. Like I think Averich is like an amazing storyteller and a really like talented writer in that sense. And I was like, well, I have no clue how to do that. So I'm just going to become obsessed with clarity above everything else and hope, and then try to like, you know, like the kind of, I think Twitter had a big impact, because on Twitter, in order to gain followers, you have to write bangers. And in order to write bangers, they have to be to the point, short sentences, can be immediately understood and make people click like. And so there are loads of parts of the book where it's like, well, what, you know, why is that sentence structured in that way? Why is there like a, you know, there's a statement where I'm like, you know, for anarchists, the stake will never wither away, full stop. It can only be violently destroyed. That's a tweet, right? There's loads of parts of the books that were deliberately in my head written as like, imagine I'm trying to write a tweet that gets like 500 likes, and that kind of shaped the writing style as well. Despite like the many things about Twitter that are nice, I do think it made me become like, I got to have punchy sentences that get people's attention. And that's kind of, I think, yeah, again, like a different style of writing to traditional historical storytelling, which I also think is really valuable, but I like didn't have that background. It was kind of like, I found it weird the extent to which my writing style is shaped by reading analytic philosophy and arguing on the internet. Those are my like two big sources for like why I write the way I do.
We've established that there's this massive like storehouse of information about key anarchists and their thoughts and the evolution of their thoughts. But being familiar with your videos and reading your work, so it's obvious, well, you make clear that anarchism didn't just emerge as like a fully formed philosophy from the heads of like the well-known key anarchists. I mean, to what extent do we actually need to understand the history of anarchism in relation to those key theorists?
So first of all is the fact that the key theorists are themselves interesting ways to access the ideas of the movement. So for example, when Kropotkin is working on his first big newspaper, he's getting feedback from the two workers in the Jura Federation who are helping him produce it. And they would give feedback on his writing style and make points, and he would incorporate them into his articles. And so what can seem to be a document that, well, this is written by Kropotkin, was really, you know, Kropotkin with the aid of these two other people who are part of the movement. Similarly, there'll be, you know, Bakunin will be making a point, and I know he's just word for word repeating what was talked about by workers at the Brussels and Basel congresses of the First International. Or, you know, Malatesta's anarchist program is adopted by the Italian Anarchist Union in, off the top of my head, 1920. And that's because the people in that movement agreed with what he was writing. So it was also an expression of their ideas, even though it was written by this individual. So I think it's important not to create a kind of like dichotomy between the big authors and the movement, because they're so interconnected. You know, it's not just that people in the movement repeat the ideas of the big authors. It's also the big authors are often repeating ideas that collectively, they're educated, articulate people often who are synthesizing ideas developed in face-to-face discussions and social movements and the press and so on. And they often view themselves as synthesizers, as well as obviously developing their own ideas. And the other thing I would say is that that was the goal of the Quote Library, was I have all the minor authors and the organizations, and that allows me to see what is a unique idea by a big author and what is the big author just repeating the program of anarchism. Things like the common ownership of the means of production, well, that's just anarchism, you know, that's not like a big name idea. Or the opposition to, you know, electoral politics. Members of the Jouve Federation came up with that as a strategy before they even met Bakunin, in response to their own experiences. And so I think the big names still need to be read. It's just always in conjunction of everything else. And I, you know, you could theoretically write, like, that would be a fun project. Like, I'm going to try and write a history of anarchism in which my rules are I'm at no point allowed to quote Bakunin, Kropotkin, Malatesta, you know, all the big names. I have to use all the obscure names and all the newspapers and nothing else. That would be like a fun project. Like, I would read that book. That would be really interesting. But it's also the case of, well, you know, there are also certain things that are going to be missing when you do that, right? So like the Conquest of Bread was extremely influential. It was one of the most printed and read texts in the movement. And you're going to be missing reference points for movement discussions, you know, like the, say, the CNT, you know, you could just refer to, for anarchist communism, the CNT's resolutions on libertarian communism. But if you then don't put that in relation to like the history of war, what did the big names have to say that the people who wrote those Congress resolutions were themselves influenced by, you're going to be missing a part of the history and the context and the causal chain that culminate, you know, in those resolutions. You know, those resolutions are interconnected with the discussions among Italian anarchists and Swiss anarchists in the First International, including big names like Guillaume, ideas on social organization, and Cafiero, you know, when they kind of adopt anarchist communism in like 1876. And so, yeah, so I feel like it's both, although I do now in my head really like the idea of trying to do a history that like is all the obscure stuff and not the kind of more well-known stuff.
I found that really interesting, and it also, at risk of straying back into process, I mean, I was reminded of what anarchist papers looked like in Spain at the turn of the century, as is my one. But, you know, they would have short clips, columns, and, you know, in more or less all the papers of usually Kropotkin at that time. That was the guy that they went to. And there would be this, there'd usually be a short, digestible reflection on something, you know, by Kropotkin there. To deny the kind of ubiquity of the big thinkers, I think is wrong. But also, like you say, you know, it's an understanding of placing them in the context that people are reading this, people are engaging with it, people are feeding back with it, you know, and those authors were aware of that and welcomed it and brought that into their own thinking as well. I think that's a really insightful point that you've brought to that. You know, you mentioned earlier, actually, that, you know, part of the origins of your work and the way that you approach work came from Reddit discussions talking about on socialism and on different factions in the left. And when me and Danny were talking about, you know, this interview and thinking about, you know, potential discussion points, this question of how other elements of the left, you know, approach these same questions about the relationship between theory and the kind of the real movement, in inverted commas. And Danny gave this example of a group which found that things weren't going as they thought they would, a Marxist group, and you know, there wasn't quite a line into what they saw around them, and their response was to return to read Capital again and hope that this second or third, fourth, fifth reading you know, elucidated that. I mean, how do you see the take-up of anarchist ideas in relation to other ways or other strands of the left might do so? Have you experienced that in your position as a YouTuber, for example? Do you think that there is a difference there in your audience, in your politics?
You know, there are some Marxists who argue by quoting Marx and Engels as if it's scripture that just like settles the matter, which always for me leads to the bizarre experience that, you know, like if I say quote a dead anarchist, they always assume that I agree with the dead anarchist because I'm quoting it. And that's the only reason why I would ever quote a dead anarchist, you know, as opposed to like, well, I'm just interested in what the dead person thought, even though, you know, I don't actually necessarily agree with everything this dead person thought. But when they quote statements, it's as orthodoxy. Obviously not all Marxists, but like some, especially online. And I think there are some anarchists who are like that online, you know, where you'll be having a discussion with them about what we should do. And they'll be like, well, Kropotkin says this. And it's like, well, okay. And that doesn't, you know, that doesn't answer our question. And I think there are anarchists who always have like a too strong pushback where they go the other way, which is we never, ever have to read any of the dead people and, you know, listen to them and think about what they said. We only have to look at, you know, modern conditions and like modern movement texts and modern like experiences, and everything else is kind of like irrelevant. And I think there's like a happy balance between those, you know, two extremes, right? To sound like an Aristotelian, but where you're kind of listening to the past and engaging with it and incorporating, you know, there are loads of valuable points made in, say, the arguments that anarchists make critiquing electoral politics as a strategy before most socialist parties had even been formed. I think it's really valuable engaging with those ideas and arguments as a modern person. And I think they do a better job of articulating those arguments than, say, a lot of modern anarchist texts that I have read that try to make the same points. But I just don't think, you know, it doesn't hit the same as Malatesta and Reclus. Like, it's not on the same level, in my opinion. And so I often see my goal is trying to, like, select the best ideas from the past and put them in a clear format so that people alive today can, like, incorporate those good ideas, but then obviously build on them, shape them to like new circumstances. You know, for modern situations, say, it's much more, I think, important to, I know, engage with the history of recent Black Lives protests in America or things like that than it is to, say, have an encyclopedic knowledge of the Paris Commune. Like, having an encyclopedic knowledge of the Paris Commune isn't super helpful for how to organize now in like London or something, even though it might have other insights. So I think it's about like striking a balance and engaging with history, but not too. If everything they said was right and everything they did worked, we would be living in anarchist communism. And so it's important to look at, well, what did they get wrong? You know, what did they, like, I think a lot of them were surprised, say, by the extent to which workers ended up identifying with the state and nationalism, especially, you know, with like the world wars. You know, I think the anarchists in the 1860s would have been surprised by the extent of how successful nationalism was as a project, for example.
I don't think it's like a question that we can just solve in the course of this conversation, you know, the relationship between like history and theory and present day practice. I mean, I find myself going between those two extremes. I don't feel like I've found the happy middle ground that you suggest, even though like I can see why it would be desirable. So why do you think it was that the Paris Commune, which obviously was a brief experience, had this profound impact in terms of the development of socialist theory subsequently, whereas these events of perhaps greater historical significance, greater depth, longevity and stuff, like the Russian Revolution, the Spanish Revolution, they seem, for a lot of people, they just seem to confirm prior, it seems to me, that you don't see like the same kind of like leaps in terms of ideas, but like, you know, a sort of increase in coherence between disparate ideas and groups.
I agree that like a lot of the big reaction to the Russian Spanish Revolution is everyone on every kind of socialist to be like, this confirms everything I already thought, right? So, you know, the hardcore anarchists say, take this is why you should never conquer state power, and the Marxists take this is why you absolutely must conquer state power. And then there are people who switch between either side, as you know, they go like, oh, the side I was on was wrong. And then they become like, they change from you know, they become a Marxist before they're anarchist, or like the other way around, in response to those things, as opposed to like we developed entirely new ideas. Although, you know, that does happen to some extent, but like I don't think it's to the same extent. They're more kind of like modifications to an already established set of ideas. With respect to the Paris Commune, so the Paris Commune happens in 1871, and the kind of bulk of what becomes the kind of core ideas on like anarchist strategy and like the anarchist vision of future society are already kind of largely in place at that point. So, you know, Bakunin before the Paris Commune was advocating the, you know, the creation of a commune during the revolution. Anarchists were already committed to anti-parliamentarianism. They were already committed to armed struggle and trade unionism. The big effect of the commune is this notion that the only option now is armed struggle because they killed so many people. Like, you know, so many people were killed in the repression of the commune that I think that led to a lot of people who'd before been like, well, you know, we can do like peaceful revolution, become hardcore revolutionaries in response to that state violence. And I think the other big factor is that there are loads of people who become anarchists in response to the commune, especially in Italy, but also like Kropotkin. You know, one of Kropotkin's like early memories as when he's becoming an anarchist is hanging out with survivors of the Paris Commune in Switzerland and just listening to their stories about what happened, including all the atrocities that were committed by the government when repressing it. Several of the delegates at Saint-Imier in 1872, when, you know, sometimes I think correctly, but, you know, framed as like the founding date for the anarchist movement, was attended by, you know, survivors of the commune. There were, you know, key people in the international who'd known people who died in the commune, like Eugene Varlin was a really key member of the... He basically advocated all the ideas the anarchists did, but didn't ever use the word anarchist because it wasn't in vogue at the time, and he died in the Paris Commune and he was killed. And so we don't know what he would have later thought, but he advocated like basically the same ideas. And obviously there were people who knew him, who were close to him, who then had to like try and continue like the struggle. Louis Michel becomes an anarchist, participates in the commune, becomes an anarchist. In her autobiography, she claims it's while she's like in the boat being taken to be imprisoned. And so I think it had this like profound psychological effect on people as this like, it's kind of like when you think about music, it's like people often have a really strong attachment to like, you know, the first bands they were really into when they were a teenager that are just the core, or same with video games, that become like the reference point for everything they subsequently experience. You know, I will always compare every role-playing game I ever played to a game called Morrowind because that's the game I obsessively played when I was 12. And I think the Paris Commune had like a similar effect, but on the consciousness of socialists, as they're always like referring back to it and using it in their arguments. You know, like Kropotkin will be like, you know, this shows that the free commune is the model of revolution. Also at the same time trying to demythologize it. So both like Kropotkin and Malatesta write critiques, you know, of the communes and its failings from like an anarchist perspective, so they can like learn lessons. And both of them complain about people who like mythologized it such that it kind of took on a life greater than its own. And it's kind of interesting to like that, you know, a similar process happens with Marxism, but it's mediated slightly differently, because obviously the key reference point is the civil war in France by Marx as a way to understand what Marxism truly is. And so it becomes a key like reference point to show that you are a true Marxist in line with what Marx thought. And there is still a similar, like, you know, different revolutionary traditions claim the commune for itself. So like when the commune first happens, there are, you know, the Bulletin of the Jura Federation, you know, claims it is like this like federalist revolt that confirms Proudhon was right and is like this anarchist revolt, like, you know, against the state. Bakunin describes it as like a revolt against the state, or at the same time being like, but it also had a government. And then later anarchists like Kropotkin will critique it like for having a government and for not being anarchist. So I think there's this kind of like interesting thing that I know it's one of my kind of research projects I want to do at some point, which is like tracking how views on the commune shift over time and how that in turn changes, like how the way in which it's used as a reference point in argument changes as more knowledge about it comes out, versus like the early days when, for example, like in Italy, key reason why Republicans become socialists in Italy, they knew very little about the commune. And often, you know, there would be like these right-wing moral panics in the Italian press about the commune, where it's like there are these crazed madmen, and also the women are setting fire to everything and don't just care about family values, and they're going to like destroy society. And the left are like reacting to that like moral panic, even though they actually don't really know much about the commune as it's happening.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I guess like there's probably a reticence about criticizing aspects of the commune while people were still living through repression or you know, obviously in the immediate aftermath of the traumatic massacres. Yeah, I think that's a really like sensible point, and probably I'd overestimated the extent to which the commune did dramatically shift ideas among like particularly more anarchistic milieu. And probably, you know, you could argue that that question was also like just daft, because obviously after the Russian Revolution, you have things like the Council Communist and the Platformist. But I think both of those don't present themselves as creating something new, do they?
Well, I think the place where it has the biggest impact is Italy, because that's the event that leads to the rise of anarchism, anarchist socialism in Italy. You know, the international Italy before the Commune is a few hundred people in Naples and an even smaller group in Sicily. And that, you know, they're not super successful, and how they become so big is essentially like a discourse war, because Mazzini, the main Republican, attacks the Commune, and then he attacks the International as being, you know, materialist and atheist and all the bad things, and not being like nationalist. And the young Republicans respond to this being like, you know, I can't believe my hero is a reactionary and is siding with the oppressors against the oppressed. And so then they write all these like attacks on Mazzini for betraying the values of radical revolutionary republicanism. Bakunin sees this opportune moment for a tweet, and he then starts writing loads of, you know, pamphlets and attacks, and so do all his friends in Italy. He's writing all these letters being like, you know, giving them advice and spreading socialist ideas. He'll be writing letters to like Republicans he knows in Italy about the discourse and about what the International stands for. And so an increasingly large number of Republicans become invested in socialism, anarchism, and the International, because they wrongly think the International is the main organizing body of the Paris Commune, when it's just one faction in the Commune. It wasn't the main organizing body. But the Italians think that. Mazzini, when he critiques the Paris Commune, therefore also critiques the International, and Mazzini even attributes Bakunin's ideas to the International, which then leads to, in the discourse, people to learn anarchist ideas and anarchism to spread through Italy because of all this like back and forth. And then when the Republican organizations become anarchists and socialists, they bring then their newspapers with them, which switch from being Republican organs to socialist ones, printing, you know, socialist texts, including crucially Bakunin's critiques of Mazzini. And so that's why by, you know, 1871, then 1872, the Italian section of the International has massively grown, and they have adopted essentially anarchist ideas. And they then become in favor of armed insurrections that create communes as a means to spread ideas. Why do they think establishing communes is such an effective way of spreading ideas? Well, because it did in Italy, and they just experienced it. So they're like, we've got to keep doing this, and you know, line go up. But you know, their attempts to do it weren't super successful. But you know, that I think was the big impact was in Italy.
I found it fascinating that, you know, Kropotkin, you know, other main thing is we're trying really hard not to mythologize the Paris Commune, to take away what was valuable, but also to critique. And that really chimed with, you know, the previous question about the relationship between theory and historical experience. And I wondered if a way of thinking about it, an idea of having maybe like solidarity with the past, or solidarity with the past events, but not a kind of faunish, just saying like everything that went before, you know, needs to be replicated and reproduced.
That's very much the point that Malatesta makes in his articles on the Commune. He's like, you know, it was mythologized, but we have to actually look at what it really was, done by, you know, real people. It's, you know, they're martyrs, it's awful what happened, etc., etc. But let's, you know, try to see what could have been done better, so next time we're in this kind of situation, we don't make the mistakes they did. And for him, that, you know, the big thing is not having a government and having an economic revolution. to defend the Paris Commune, which he also makes the point, well, they didn't really have much time. Like, it was very short. and it was before socialism, what, you know, it wasn't on the scale of, say, like, what the anarchist movement was in Spain when the Spanish Revolution happens in France, in terms of, like, organizational capacity. You know, there are certain things that, say, happened, I think, really quickly during the Spanish Revolution in terms of the economic component of the revolution and the expropriations and the communalization, that, you know, the Paris Commune doesn't happen. But it's like, well, yeah, the Paris Commune was, like, smaller. The international was small. There were loads of different factions that, you know, it was, they were having lots of debates about aspects of the economy and what to do about it. But, well, before they could really implement a lot of it, they get killed because it only lasted a few months.
I want to finish with a big question. We have a history of anarchism. You know, that history is growing all the time. And you've made a fantastic contribution and are continuing to make a fantastic contribution to that. But do we have, like, anarchist history? I know that you're a fan of Shokunishi's book, as I am as well. You know, that actually presents it. Shokunishi actually presents that work as anarchist history, like invoking anarchism as a kind of methodology appropriate to the writing of history. Would you think that that's an idea that has legs, or do you relate to it at all, like the idea of writing not just history of anarchism, but writing anarchist history?
So in my head, the way I think about it is anarchist history is just labor history that takes anarchism seriously. Because labor historians who aren't anarchists but are Marxists, they write mythology. They don't write history. They often just make things up, massively extrapolate from a small number of sources, or especially secondary sources, to, like, the entire movement. I'm currently writing, like, a takedown of a Marxist historian about anarchism in Italy, in which every sentence is false. He's like, oh, you know, it was mainly in the South. And then I look up his own source, and it's like, it was overwhelming. It began in the South, but it was overwhelmingly in the North Central region. So he's, like, totally wrong. And so in my head, it's like the principles of labor history, where it's like, you know, history from below, which, again, like, the anarchists talk about, you know, Kropotkin did history from below when he wrote an entire history of the French Revolution. You know, key peoples in the generation of history from below were anarchist authors, you know, before the kind of later, like, academic versions of it with, you know, like Hobsbawm and E.P. Thompson and so forth. And so that history from below, where it's like you're focusing on, you know, class struggle, on what ordinary people thought, on the sources that they themselves produced, on looking at, you know, things from their point of view rather than the point of view of, like, rich people, although all those techniques of labor history are still totally viable. And I think one of the interesting things that's happened with anarchist history is this emphasis on networks, where, you know, anarchists historically organized through networks, among other things, and now network theory is being used to actually also then understand anarchist past by modern historians, like, you know, Toccato, and also, of course, you know, the print culture book. And I think that's kind of really interesting, where, like, we're thinking, because of how they organized, we're then having to think in terms of networks, which in turn shapes the kind of approach to history we do in terms of, like, you know, looking at nodes and how they interact as the organizational structure, just because for lots of periods, you know, there wasn't a big formal federation for various reasons. So I think there's also a weird sense in which there's a kind of feedback between the history we're studying and how we talk about it, and that in turn being kind of anarchist. The tweet is, it's labor history that takes anarchism seriously.
What about how seriously we take, like, that kind of, the question of, say, the economic, or, like, what is sometimes put crudely as, like, you know, questions of base and superstructure and things like this. Obviously, you've explained on several occasions there are, you know, the overlaps in socialist thought between, like, Marxists and anarchists when it comes to, you know, the critique of capitalism and things like this. And it seems to me that, you know, to an extent that applies to an understanding of history that appreciates, like, the capitalist, like, social relations as marking a new kind of epoch in history that raises with it, like, certain new opportunities or possibilities, and obviously new classes, which rejects, like, the more classic Marxist teleology, you know, that this is, like, a necessarily positive stage or a necessary stage that is laying the groundwork for socialism. It seems like, you know, an anarchist history could go sort of part way with that sort of methodology while breaking with some of its assumptions.
Yeah, I think part of the thing here is that, you know, that historical anarchists have a lot of social theory in common, but there is no like set of texts that they all refer back to for where they get their social theory from. And so what this then means is that, well, when modern historians who aren't the dead people approach things and they're looking for methodologies, there isn't like a set of texts to study, like Capital, to be like, okay, this is how we think about the economy, and I can then incorporate this into my historical work. Because with the anarchist art, there's so much variety, right? So like Malatesta in the 1880s has a much more hardcore version of economic determinism than Marx does. He is a more hardcore economic determinist than Marx. And he himself later says, you know, we were more Marxists than perhaps Marx himself. And I like unironically agree in terms of like, if by that you mean like a caricature of Marx as like economic determinism, it's like, yeah, that they were more committed to it in a bad way. Like it was, you know, it was too reductionist. And obviously other anarchists, you know, weren't, that they think in terms of like complex interaction between different factors, which includes the economy. The economy isn't necessarily causally primary. And I think part of it is often like, there's this weird thing where there's some Marxists who approach, their approach to history isn't like Marx's actual views. It's weirdly mediated through historical experience itself, whereby they interpret Marx through the lens provided to them by Kautsky and Plekhanov and Stalin and so forth. And they then use that to then think about history, including itself the history of Marxism, when like Marx's actual views, I think, are like are way more complicated and say don't have like that teleological component that you know, some kind of versions of historical materialism do. And so I'm kind of in favor of, you know, like a synthesis of the best of anarchism and Marxism, where the focus is on, well, what works and what's true. And if that's the focus, then the question of developing a distinctly anarchist approach to history that's totally different, is nothing like how Marxists do it, well, isn't really relevant, because the process is always what's true, what works, what is helpful and useful for conceptualizing things. And, you know, I don't think we should just incorporate like, you know, Marxists. We could also say like, read modern philosophy of science, modern science itself, look at how, say, they incorporate systems theory, and then think about how systems theory can be helpful for how we think about history. Or same with, you know, like modern network theory, right? And so I kind of don't have an approach of like, what did the dead anarchists think? Oh no, there's no consensus. I can't use this as a basis for constructing an approach to history. It's like, well, just like, you know, pick bits and also incorporate modern stuff and see. The mistake is always to ignore reality because it doesn't fit the model. The starting point must almost be reality, and then through, you know, a process of abstraction, developing a model that corresponds to it and is useful for understanding it. And the key emphasis should always be on explanatory power, as opposed to, you know, orthodoxy or being concerned with like labels. Because I think you can then end up rejecting good ideas just because they don't correspond to the sets of labels that you've like internalized.
Thanks for listening. You can keep in touch with the podcast via our email, abcwithdannyandjim@gmail.com. And our now very limited presence on Twitter can be found under the handle @abcdannyandjim. You can subscribe to our newsletter at abcwithdannyandjim.substack.com. The podcast music is Stealing Orchestra and Rafael Dionisio, Gente de Miniaterra. The podcast logo is an adapted version of the Left Book Club logo. And the image in this episode is the cover art of Zoe's book. Love and solidarity. Until next time.
więc ja się mam powołać, już nas już to raz, już nie masz krzymścić. Sły skrytali kształtów, poszło w urody, to je po ławę, powiedzmy.
Panie prezydencie.